I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/FU Network TV, and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
Now, let's listen.
He clearly saw this person who works for him as a human being and not just simply a means to an end, not just simply a cog in the corporate machine. So to have a CEO who cares that much about the people he works with, he had human emotions. I'm just impressed with the courage it took. Are you crying any tears for the loss of Soleimani?
Well, you know, for him as a person, you know, no, there's the world is full of bad actors like him. I mean, there's 195 countries in the world, and there are only, you know, maybe a dozen of those countries that are nice countries. The rest of them are full of bad actors, war criminals, people who are terrible to their own people, people who are terrible to other people's people. You know, the world is full of terrible people, and always has been.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen.
Oh,
Happy New Year.
To you, too. And will it be? I don't know.
Well, it's shaping up to be a doozy already.
Yeah, because, 2019 was, I'll say this out of respect for your mom who listens, a poop show. And 2020, but it started out with less of a poop show, and slowly the size of the output, the pile of poop grew and grew and grew. 2020 starts out with a massive diarrhea of world events, of conflict, of people screaming in panic, people unaware of even recent history, history as recent as 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and social media just fanning flames, making people afraid. I remember when I was growing up in high school, the theory was that was being pushed forward by general public was, we're going to have a nuclear war. There's going to be a nuclear war. Reagan's in office. There's going to be a nuclear war. Teachers would say this. There was all kinds of movies and TV about people after a nuclear war. It was sort of a given that there was going to be a nuclear war, and I didn't believe that there would be. I knew people who engaged in destructive behaviors because they said, what difference does it make? We're all going to die in a nuclear war. And I saw some of that panic greatly, you know, recreated in front of my eyes after the drone strike that killed the Iranian general Soleimani, ordered by Donald Trump without approval of Congress. And we'll get to process, and that's a thorny issue, because are you crying any tears for the loss of Soleimani?
Well, you know, for him as a person, you know, no, there's the world is full of bad actors like him. I mean, there's 195 countries in the world, if you include Vatican City and the Palestinian state. And there are only, you know, maybe a dozen of those countries that are nice countries. The rest of them are full of bad actors, war criminals, people who are terrible to their own people, people who are terrible to other people's people. You know, the world is full of terrible people, and always has been.
Yeah.
No one will shed a lot of tears for Soleimani. Although, you know, in fairness, in Iran, you know, among a certain group of people, and actually a large group of people, you know, he is considered a war hero. It's all a question of perspective. You know, he is, odd as it may sound to our ears, you know, he was much respected and loved as an Iranian leader. So, you know, clearly, you know, he isn't an evil actor to everybody.
Well, no, usually, I mean, you know, Lex
Every
Luthor,
regime has its fans.
Lex Luthor doesn't believe himself a villain either.
Nope.
But we'll get to that because it is a thorny issue because it brings a few things together and people on social media seem unable to untie that Gordian knot. But I'd like to start by talking about the letter from the CEO of Maple Leaf Foods, Michael McCain, who stated in a small Twitter thread Sunday night that he was still outraged and in mourning because one of his employees at Maple Leaf Foods lost his wife and 11-year-old son in the Ukrainian jet that was downed in the fog of war during the hostilities between Iran and the United States. And he went on to very succinctly, I think, it was actually beautifully succinctly, sum up his opinions about what precipitated these deaths. And it was a statement that contained a partisan political view. It was anti-Trump. And I thought, my God, the first person who sent it to me, I said, is this for real? Because we're used to CEOs being absolute craven cowards. Now, maybe they have a reason for it, which is that their jobs are basically quarter to quarter, and they can be top of the world one quarter and out on the street the next quarter. And so they're exceptionally careful about what they say, to the point where they don't actually say anything. They use words, but they don't actually say anything. And all of those words are heavily focus grouped and sanitized and put through a shitifier to just make sure that they are as inoffensive as possible. And again, I understand why, because we're in this, you know, it was always said before social media that you can't please everybody. Now with social media, it seems you can't please anybody. And so whatever you put out there, it doesn't matter what it is, it's putting red meat in front of a pack of hungry dogs. And so to see a CEO who was so overcome with emotion, not just even overcome with emotion, admitting emotion. Usually these CEOs like to see put forward an image of strength and being very taciturn, and you know, to see that this is, to see the human heart beating behind the corporate facade of a CEO like Michael McCain, who was he runs a very large company, was for me a whoa moment, a Keanu Reeves moment, a whoa. Here's a human being who was talking like a human being to other human beings. Here's a human being who has experienced loss and is talking like a human being who has experienced loss. And he then went on to state a personal opinion, which he did on the Maple Leaf Foods Twitter site. Both of these are things that we don't see these days. And I thought, I was stunned at the from my point of view, the absolute bravery and courage of convictions, and the emotion and the legitimate feeling of loss that one of his employees lost wife and son, when a lot of CEOs simply say, don't bring your problems to the office. Yeah. It was, for me, this was, I hope, a watershed moment in how company, and it's going to depend upon how it's received, of course, and what at the end of the day, was this a benefit or not? But I hope this is a watershed moment.
Yeah, there's an interesting, you know, I found it interesting that there is immediately a backlash. I mean, it was the usual suspects, of course, you know, with the hashtag, you know, boycott Maple Leaf Foods. Because like you said, it came out through the Maple Leaf corporate Twitter account. It wasn't, I don't know if McCain has a personal Twitter account.
He does.
Oh, he does. Okay. Yes. I just assumed he was too busy for that kind of thing. But like I say, it came out through the Maple Leaf Foods account, and it, the McCain family, you know, they're no strangers to controversy. Usually it's, internal family problems that they hit the newspapers.
Yeah.
The McCains have been, they are public figures as much as we have public figures in Canada.
Well, they're almost like, to use an old TV reference to Dallas, they're like the Ewings of meat.
Yeah, that's not a bad, that's not a bad,
based analogy on the way that the family battles and internecine family battles have played out in the public, and the soap opera that we have seen unfold in that family, which, just goes to prove just because you have money doesn't mean you have happiness.
No, it's true. Well, interestingly enough, I mean, and there's no shortage of condemnation of, you know, whether it's Trump or the Iranians for being trigger happy at their missile silos. But, you know, the interesting thing is, you know, we've had people of Iranian descent. We've had the, you know, whether it's been colleagues, family members who've had, they've actually been, you know, a bit restrained for the most part, I thought, in their denunciations. Obviously they're incredibly sad and they denounce Iran and they want answers for this terrible occurrence. But I found it interesting that, and you know, maybe this is just the lens I look at things through, that McCain, a white CEO of an established Canadian family, finally says some of the things that the families have been saying as well, that, this wouldn't have happened but for, Trump's adventurism in meddling in Middle Eastern affairs. The Iranians are also to blame for their sloppy handling of their missiles and the poor control they have over their
command
their
and control
system.
Apparatus,
or the lack of command and control. But as soon as, McCain says it, everyone jumps on him because it's like, well, it's okay for the Persians to be condemning the Iranians, but as soon as a white guy is condemning it, also now all of a sudden the suspects, and that's Ezra Levant, and that is the hardcore conservative side of things.
I don't even call them hardcore conservatives. I consider them right wing.
Yeah.
Conservatism. They're not political conservatives, especially a guy like Ezra Levant is a con man huckster mold. A carnival barker presentation, and who knows where his bread is buttered, and that butter is money that comes from hardcore bigots. Not all of them, but I can't see anyone who's not a hardcore bigot giving money to support what Ezra Levant puts out on his website, because I've never seen anything there that I could say was even approaching the neighborhood of reasonable discourse or reasonable analysis of news. It activated the dogs on the right wing side.
Yeah, the usual suspects. And I say, and that made even worse. If for some reason, the families of the affected people are given a pass on this, on being outraged and sad and denouncing.
Families absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And for McCain too. I mean, obviously, this person, his colleague's wife and their 11-year-old son, who are killed in the disaster. I mean, obviously, it hit very, very close to home for him to do this, because this seems to be a genuine cri de coeur that he threw aside, whether it's business concerns and all the rest.
The torpedoes, full speed ahead, and to have a CEO who cares that much about the people he works with, we don't know, at least I don't know, at what level this colleague works at Maple Leaf Foods. But that he clearly saw this person who works for him as a human being and not just simply a means to an end, not just simply a cog in the corporate machine. He had human emotions, and he said, he's not a stupid man. He knew there would be fallout for this, but he also knew that, or believed that, what's right is right, and you have to stand up sometimes and say when something is wrong. And I just was stunned, impressed, the respect I gained. I'm just impressed with what the courage it took. Now, some might say it was reckless. I don't think that a man who's been through as much corporate intrigue and battles as him does these things recklessly. I don't think he's one who is given to flights of emotion where he's not Donald Trump, where something irks him and he immediately goes to Twitter and puts it out there. I would love to see, he is more bold than many governments in the world. What he said was more bold than business leaders in the United States, and certainly leaders in the Republican Party. So,
even being bold, you look at his actual words. I mean, it's very, very hard for me anyway, to take exception to the facts as he laid them out in his series of tweets as well. I mean, you know, he uses certain inflammatory language that that Trump supporters are not going to be happy with. He calls him Trump a narcissist who
well, yeah, truth, the world the truth hurts. Yeah,
well, exactly. And, you know, and the fact that he has destabilized things, that the government, as he said, is unconstrained by checks and balances, and concocted, an ill-conceived plan to divert focus from political woes, I mean, the impeachment. And I look at that and go, well, yeah, that's all pretty self-evident, isn't it? I mean, this wasn't, you know, you've seen the defenders in the White House stumble all over themselves trying to come up after the fact with, oh, no, there was imminent threats in one, no, four embassies that were going to be attacked. We don't know where and when, but, you know, but trust us. Yeah, and somebody, one commentator said, you know, you kind of missed the Bush era with Cheney, where they still lied to you, but at least they respected you enough to come up with a lie in advance that they thought held together enough that doesn't insult your intelligence. And you watch them stumbling over themselves trying to justify the assassination of Soleimani. And they, you know, it just is so hollow and so false, and it's just so clear that, you know, Trump just wanted to have a win, ask for an easy, soft target that they could hit in the meantime. They've had a thing about Iran for ages. And frankly, you know, on the world stage, Iran is a bit player. I mean, they're still mad about the hostage situation. But,
well, listen, you're talking about a president who still thinks that the Central Park Five are guilty, even though they've been exonerated. This is a man who stopped paying attention to news somewhere in the 1980s, and that would be why he is still so crazy anti-Iran. I mean, you know what? Maybe it makes sense to read the statement by Michael McCain, okay, which I'll do now. It's on his Twitter feed. It's on the Maple Leaf Foods Twitter feed, at Maple Leaf Foods. I'm Michael McCain, CEO of Maple Leaf Foods, and these are personal reflections. I am very angry, and time isn't making me less angry. Maple Leaf Foods colleague of mine lost his wife and family this week to a needless, irresponsible series of events in Iran. U.S. government leaders, unconstrained by checks and balances, concocted an ill-conceived plan to divert focus from political woes. The world knows Iran is a dangerous state, but the world found a path to contain it. Not perfect by most accounts, but it was the right direction. A narcissist in Washington tears world accomplishment apart, destabilizes region. Now, U.S. now unwelcomed everywhere in the area, including Iraq. Tensions escalated to feverish pitch. Taking out despicable military leader terrorist? ? There are 100 like him standing in line. Sorry, I'm going to read that again, and I'll edit it. Taking out despicable military leader terrorist, there are 100 like him standing next in line. The collateral damage of this irresponsible, dangerous, ill-conceived behavior? 63 Canadians needlessly lost their lives in the crossfire, including the family of one of my Maple Leaf Food colleagues, in brackets his wife, and 11-year-old son. We are mourning, and I am livid. And he signs it, Michael McCain.
Yeah, I say there's not an awful lot controversial in that. I mean,
well, he places the blame fairly even-handedly. He's not letting Iran off the hook.
Nope.
He's, you know, making it clear that Iran is on the world stage a bad actor.
Yeah.
And
they did fire the missiles.
And they did fire the missiles. And, you know, the sadly, darkly ironic thing is that during the fog of war in a previous century, towards the close of the last century, it was a U.S. military vehicle that downed an Iranian commuter airplane full of just regular passengers because their telemetry was off, and they read it as a F-14 Tomcat.
Yeah, it was in 1988, I think. An Iranian air flight, I think it was 655, and they killed 290 people. The U.S. Navy, you know, the USS Vincennes, in the fog of war, shot down a passenger aircraft,
and killed a lot of people. And it's we're seeing here a flip side of the same kind of tragedy. And of course, the common denominator: innocent civilians on a plane getting caught in the saber rattling between two nations. And you know, it was interesting because what McCain said, which is that he called attention to the fact that those on the left in social media have not, I've not seen, been reflecting, which is that Iran is not a good actor on the world stage. They are a world sponsor of terrorism. They destabilize the world every day. They work to destabilize the world every day through terrorism. And so when people focus specifically on Trump, who I've made it very clear, I have the negative integers on the respect scale that I have for him are off the mark. I mean, he is somebody who has demonstrated a lack of self-control that you usually see in a two-year-old. The thin skin that you see in perhaps an infant or a toddler. The ability to comprehend circumstances and situations and consequences of a child. The arrogance of somebody born rich who thinks that because he was born rich, that meant he was born smarter and better than everybody else, as opposed to, you know, born into a family that one way or another managed to make some money. He's a despicable human being. If in fact, I'm not even sure that I can consider him a human being, but to hear nothing but criticism of the fact that Soleimani was taken out by this drone strike, the left is glossing over the fact that A, Iran is a world sponsor of terrorism and not an innocent actor, and B, Soleimani was not an innocent actor. He is, by many accounts, the chief architect of numerous terrorist attacks that have taken innocent lives over the past number of years. You know, my concern is that Trump did this without the approval of Congress, and he did it ostensibly to distract the news cycle from the fact that there's articles of impeachment going forward and his popularity is dropping. He used it to change the channel. He risked the lives of innocent people simply to try to improve his political fortunes. That aspect is completely open for, in my opinion, for the most harsh criticism that you can pull out. But to depict the victim of this, Soleimani, as some kind of innocent actor just out having a picnic with his family, this is dishonest. And you can hate Trump and you can disagree with what he did and how he went about doing it, and at the same time say, I'm not losing any tears for the death of Soleimani. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I start from the standpoint that, you know, it's wrong to assassinate people. And if you start from there, the whole thing becomes pretty easy. I mean, if you're in the middle of a war and you have legitimate targets, then that's war. But this isn't war. I mean, the Middle East is so incredibly complicated, and there's so many proxy fights going on and all the rest. And, you know, trying to figure out, you know, who's the worst villain and criminal out there, and, you know, decide who needs to be marked for death. I think it's judging from the way the White House has fumbled over the last little while, you know, there was clearly no imminent fear that Soleimani was up to something that was going to result in, you know, the deaths of Americans.
Well, there's conflicting information, but he has been responsible for the deaths of Americans and other Western nationals.
Well, and so is George Bush. I mean, you know, or Dick Cheney. I mean, these people have put all kinds of people to death in pointless and stupid wars. You know, that's not the standard, you know, where, you know, that you pass death sentences in someone else's country on somebody else. You know, you look at, you know, so one of the worst actors in the Middle East is Saudi Arabia, and those people are buddy-buddy, you know, with the White House, with Trump, with his son-in-law. I mean, these are the people who sent someone in with bone saws to kill a journalist, to kill Khashoggi. And, you know, there's, you know, they've had a massive program in Yemen where they've got, you know, the whole population starving to death. I mean, these are bad, bad actors. But do we see assassinations of Saudis who are doing this? You know, they behead people, who are apostates, who are Christians, who women who are fighting for civil rights. I mean, does that mark them for death? Or is it only because, you know, that American servicemen who are in one of the 100 or so bases that surround the Iran and Iraq, are in harm's way? You know, if they're in harm's way and they get harmed, that's part of it. That's part of, the acceptable losses of being in foreign jurisdictions with massive military forces and pouring gas on the fire. So you can't blame somebody necessarily for acting as a general fighting a war that is, it's a undeclared war. But do you start assassinating people that you don't like? And that's the reach. What if Russia started doing this? You know, if they started killing people in France who they
What do you mean, what if they started? No. They drop polonium into people's tea, or they scratch them with a polonium-tipped umbrella.
Yep, they do.
This is not new for Russia.
And was the West outraged by that? I mean, I was actually in the hotel where the Russian target was staying. I got a note under my door at the Park Lane Hotel in downtown London, where giving me a note saying, "Well, don't go up to the seventh floor because we're doing some cleanup up there." It turns out later it was polonium they were looking for. There's assassinations that happen all over the place, but it was condemned in the West roundly by the United States, by England. You don't do that, or you don't get caught doing that. The Americans are having an overt campaign of sending in drones and then bragging about killing people in their home countries, or in a country that isn't the United States and that the United States isn't at war with.
We could do a whole show or series of shows.
And this isn't because I like Soleimani. I just don't think responsible government should be going around the world assassinating people they don't like. And as McCain said, there's hundreds of people worse than Soleimani wandering around the world. There's African, strongmen, dictators, there's warlords, there's genocidal maniacs all over the place. The United States doesn't care about those people particularly.
Well, the world is a very messy place. And we often
where do you stop is the other question.
I mean, where do you stop and where do you start?
Thin edge of the wedge arguments, but I think there are supposedly rules about who you can assassinate, set down in American convention and law, and this is the imminent threat thing. If somebody is going to blow up the World Trade Center, then by the way, most of those people were Saudis. They weren't Iranians.
Yes, they were. They were Saudi Arabians. Yes.
As a little bit of an aside, just today as we're recording this, the United States has expelled a whole bunch of Saudis, about 900 foreign nationals who are taking military training in the United States after that shooting in was it Pensacola? I think it was in Pensacola at the Air Force Base, where they where one of the Saudis, once again, nationals who was studying there at their war college opened fire on people in the name of jihad.
It's funny, they'll do that, but when a white supremacist kills a young woman, the president says that
there's
fine
good people on both sides.
Yeah, there's fine people on that side. Yeah, he didn't do anything to round up the people in that march. He didn't do anything to create guilt by association. But when you are of a particular ethnicity, you're all guilty because one of you did something. Yeah. If that means the rest of you are likely to.
Yeah, and
it's just the same theory behind why we interred Japanese people during World War II. You can't trust them. Yeah. It's been going on for so long.
Well, and the rules for assassinating, which I don't agree with, because I think assassination is just wrong. Doesn't matter who it is, unless you're in the middle of a war. Like I saw somebody today, there was a Jewish author who was saying, well, this was just like the assassination of Reinhard Heydrich, who was assassinated by Czech partisans in 1942. But they were at war. Heydrich was a war criminal who was liquidating Eastern Europe's Jews. yeah, he's a legitimate target, absolutely. Now, Soleimani, there isn't a state of war. There is certainly not a hot war going on. And so it goes down to what the Americans' own rules are about assassinating, which, again, I don't agree with, which is if there's an imminent threat to America, then we can take somebody out. And this came up originally during the Bush year. And in fairness, Obama had one of the largest drone strike campaigns going on. Most of it was in Afghanistan.
The difference also is that he got his approved by Congress.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the real difference, is that he followed the rules of co-equal branches of government. He wasn't an autocrat who decided, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this. And, you know, if you hear the stories, the generals present the president with a series of options, and there's always one option, which is the most inflammatory, irresponsible, option, and they present that knowing that or believing that this is so extreme, he'll never go for this. And Trump actually is the first president to have gone for the most extreme, possibility. And it stunned the generals there because they were thinking, we only put that there, as something that, okay, it is a possibility, but it's not the one that we recommend. And he went for went crazy and went for the biggest one.
Yeah. And I think the most egregious part of the whole thing is the motivation for doing that is political. It is to benefit Trump's political fortunes at a time when he needs it badly, because the impeachment thing is hurting him. Mitch McConnell finally just dismisses the whole thing out of hand. The impeachment thing is clearly bothering him, and nothing makes a right winger happier than a show of force and a distraction, a wag the dog, where you can say, look, this, I saved America by killing somebody, by sending in drones or the airborne or whoever else. And the fact that Soleimani was assassinated for the political gain of Donald Trump is the most egregious part of this. He may have been a bad actor. He may have been all kinds of things, but the main motivation for this, because we've been given no evidence, and most of the evidence we do have points the other direction, no evidence that this was actually a national security imminent threat problem. It was because Trump needed to win, and he really needed, if you want to go back to the Middle Ages, someone's head to put on a pike and put on the castle gate and say, look what a great ruler I am. And that's the reason that he did it.
Yeah.
And that's wrong.
The distasteful part. I mean, beyond distasteful is the motivation behind doing it. I don't share your disillusionment with assassinations. I think that sometimes taking out certain people is preferable to bombing entire neighborhoods or a hot war that takes down more civilians, targeted surgical strikes, assassinations on people who are planning things that are endemic to your countrymen. I think that's completely fair game, and I think it's actually a better approach to take than dropping bunker buster bombs and destroying whole neighborhoods. I prefer that. But that's when circumstances call for that. The circumstances, and did Soleimani deserve to die? In my view, absolutely. Did he deserve the death penalty inflicted on him for his involvement in terrorist activities around the world over the years that have killed people? Absolutely. But was this the time to do it? Was this the place to do it? Because there's a lot of people out there, as you pointed out, who really do, by our Western standards, deserve to die because they're horrible to their people and they're horrible to other people's people. But you have to balance things out, when you're looking at the world stage. And you have to be responsible when you're a superpower like the United States, knowing that when the elephant rolls over, when he's sleeping with the mouse, it's not going to go well for the mouse. And so when you have the strength the United States does, as Uncle Ben said to Spider-Man as he was dying, with great power comes great responsibility. Well, what we saw was an example of great power and no responsibility. And, yes, Soleimani is dead. And like pointed out by Michael McCain, do you think that he was some evil genius and that there's no other person in Iran who's just going to step into that same place. It's the same, you know, it was like during the Mueller investigation. People were saying, you know, Trump's going to fire Mueller, but also pointed out that they can fire Mueller, but the Mueller investigation would continue. So taking out Soleimani, while he may have deserved it as a human being, it actually isn't going to stop anything, because these weren't plans that he kept locked in his head that he shared with nobody. So killing him means that, aha, that's not going to happen. There's paperwork. There's underlings. There's people who worked under him, who are going to be promoted, who are fully aware. So he didn't stop anything.
Yeah, and in fact, often the people who are second or third in command are worse than the guy at the top. We've seen this over and over in history where, you know, there's always someone who is, you know, even more evil and bloodthirsty and all the rest, just waiting in the wings for the opportunity. The Americans are great at creating vacuums. They create power vacuums, and they've got no plan for what happens the next day. And you end up with people who are even worse enemies and more ruthless to their own people and outward to the rest of the world, who fill in the vacuum left by an American drone strike.
Yeah, I think the thing that bothered me the most, probably two things. One, the inability of the news media to communicate to the public the fact that killing Soleimani, who was a terrorist mastermind, and how it was done are two separate issues. You can discuss each of them separately. And they each have their own texture to them and background. One is, we can talk about what Soleimani did and his contributions to the world. But you can also look at the fact that the world's last remaining superpower militarily, the person in charge of it, does not seem to believe in the rule of law within his own country. And the processes and checks and balances on the U.S. military that were designed by the founders of the United States to not allow somebody to be an absolute leader and just decide, wake up one day and send a drone to kill somebody. The fact that he broke those rules, didn't even inform the Democrats that he was supposed to inform. Because, you know, that might have meant he wouldn't be allowed to do what he wanted to do. And, you know, it's a variation of, it's easier to get forgiveness than permission. But he was hoping to get adulation instead of forgiveness by his side, the people who, no matter what he does, you know, he once said he could kill someone on Fifth Avenue and his fans would support him. And I think that's true, because this is a cult of personality, not people who, you know, they call themselves good Americans, but good Americans believe in supporting the system of government of the United States and the legal system of the United States. People who don't support that and who think that it's just getting in the way, that it's just red tape, I would say that the America that those people love isn't the America that was founded by the founding fathers, isn't the America that's in the Constitution, isn't the America that's in the legal books, and isn't the America that built myths around itself as the world's honest cop for so many years. So there's those two separate issues there that can be discussed, but they were being pushed together. And, you know, it's like you take red and you take blue, and what we got was everybody discussing purple instead of looking at the component parts. And that's one thing that really bothered me. And as a result of that, the way the people on the left were not acknowledging that this person who was killed, this Iranian general who was killed, was a piece of crap and was responsible for numerous civilian deaths. They seemed to be sympathetic to the death of this person, instead of saying, hey, my concern is rule of law, following rule of law, which I can get behind. And then there was the other thing, which is the overall panic that this was going to cause World War III, which revealed just how little people in the world know about what the world conditions were like, international conditions were like when there were world wars, and what the world is like now when our economies are so interdependent upon each other that nobody can afford a world war. Nobody can afford it. It will wind up hurting
rational person can afford it. And the problem, of course, is we don't have a lot of rational people in charge of the White House these days. And I think that's what the heightened concern is that we will stumble towards war as opposed to figure out
nobody's going to go to war for Iran. There's not going to be nations lining up to go to war on behalf of Iran. Iran is a rogue nation within the Arab world. Saudi Arabia has forged greater ties behind the scenes with Israel because their common enemy is Iran. Iran can't really unleash a nuke on Israel without irradiating the Arab states that neighbor Israel and Palestinians and Arabs living in Israel and the Palestinian territories that surround Israel. It's not possible for them to do that. They can't claim to be big supporters of the Palestinians and then do something which is going to kill masses of them.
I'm sure in 1914, no one thought the world would go to war over a little place called Bosnia, which no one could find on the map either.
It set in motion
a series of things that stumbled towards a global conflict that lasted 4 years and cost 80 million lives. And it was a small local flare up, by members of a tiny Bosnian terrorist group called the Black Hand when they assassinated Franz Ferdinand, which set Russia into conflict with Austria, which brought in Germany, and next thing you know, they're in Belgium and World War I's going on. And this is the problem in the Middle East. It is a powder keg. I mean, you've got Turkey going after the Kurds. You've got the Americans sort of in and out of Iraq. You've got proxy wars going all over the place. I mean, 20 years ago, the proxy wars were all in Lebanon.
World War III has been going on. The fighting didn't stop at the end of World War II. Instead, it moved to proxy wars, marionettes of the superpowers. But the fact is that now Iran doesn't have the money to wage a war. Russia, which people think would be a natural ally to back Iran because it's anti-US, Russia doesn't have the money to go and project force internationally. There simply isn't the money. Japan's not going to give them the money. Japan is already so overextended as far as their the ratio of debt to GDP. They don't have the money nor the interest in funding something that's going to harm the United States when they hold the majority of the United States debt. A United States which is harmed by military actions doesn't serve Japan. China just is not going to get in into a shooting war with the United States. So it's not Japan that holds the debt, it's China. China's not going to get into supporting a shooting war with ground troops in a full-scale world war because incorrectly put Japan where China is. China's debt to GDP ratio is unsustainable. The growth that they've had, it has come at great cost, and it's unsustainable. Nobody can afford to put troops on the ground. So the idea that there will be a World War III is so exceptionally unlikely because world conditions today are remarkably different than they were prior to World War II and prior to World War I.
Well, if you got to look at, it wasn't that long ago that Iraq and Iran were having a war and millions of people died in that war. And, they were fighting with World War II level weapons. I mean, it was small arms or people were literally running onto the battlefield with sticks and axes and swords in some places. They had some high tech weapons as well that they could beg, borrow or steal from, because there's always people who are prepared to fund war because war is good for business. And, that war raged for years. And, a lot of this, and we can't discount the fact that the Saudis are Sunni, and the Iranians are Shia, and that fight, and the Iraqis are like the Saudis are Sunni as well. I mean, the religious wars, those are not rational wars. Those aren't wars that people fought with bankers in the back pocket. These were religious wars, very much like we had in Europe in the 1200s. It was these are not rational wars, and the problem is they spill out. In some ways, what's going on in Iran is a Saudi proxy war as well. There's all kinds of proxy wars going on, whether they're agents of Israel or agents against Israel. Everyone in that area is jockeying, and it just takes somebody to lose their cool, and it turns ugly. And then you start drawing in the big groups, not because they want to be in, because they're protecting their interests. Trump had, in a moment of honesty, said, we're leaving troops behind to grab their oil. This is about oil, a lot of this as well.
Which is kind of odd because of the fact that the U.S. is oil self-sufficient and an exporter of oil. Again, his mindset is back in the 80s. We can still remember the energy crisis. Yep. He's still thinking of OPEC. Perhaps you and I disagree on the percentage likelihood that we're standing
I hope you're right. I mean, I think it'll be a little more limited to, I can't see any of the major powers. Well, the United States might go in out of a sense of adventurism. Russia has already, shown its ability to sort of push out into what it considers its areas of influence with Crimea. And, they're selling weapons, whether it's to Turkey or to Iraq, or they're equipping militias as well. So there are these enormous proxy wars being funded by East and West that are taking place in the Middle East. But one of the things that I really objected to, and you sort of mentioned it as well, that the Republicans and sort of the right wingers generally have equated this respect for the rule of law and this general idea that we shouldn't be assassinating people, just as sort of a rule of thumb, as some they've equated it with some sort of love for Soleimani. It's like, and you saw this, Kelly said it, and it's been said on Fox News, that all these Democrats are crying over Soleimani. It's like, not crying over Soleimani. Like you said, he was an evil bastard. He was probably better dead than alive. But the whole thing is that we're crying for the principle that it is wrong to go into another country and assassinate people, because that's a Pandora's box that you don't want to open, especially if you're doing it without the authorization of Congress or in compliance with your own rules about, God help us, who you're allowed to assassinate. That's what, I don't cry for Soleimani. I cry for what it does to us when we condone that kind of action, because it impoverishes us as a people when we do that sort of thing. Whether it's the American, Canadians aren't big on assassination. We've only had two political assassinations in our history, and that's plenty for us. It impoverishes the Americans to allow this sort of cowboy adventurism unchecked, as McCain said in his tweet posts, that this is just ad hockery.
I don't think, first of all, that we're going to see much more of that, because if you saw the press conference last week that Trump held, which trended on Twitter as, what was it, Sleepy McAdderall? People said that he was
slurring his words. And
yes, and mm-hmm. I think that what probably happened was, and this is just my speculation, that the generals got together and realized he can't fire all of us at once.
Hitler said the same thing, actually, and he fired them all and got his own people.
Well, the thing is, Trump, he fires people and then doesn't replace them. And
yes,
there are a record number of very important positions in the United States government that have not been and will not be filled because no one wants to work there. Got together and said, look, he can't fire us all without hurting himself with his base. He'll look weak with the military. There aren't other generals that will line up to support him. There's not that many that are mad dogs that have the credentials to be generals of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I think they finally put their foot down and said, okay, we kept our mouths shut before, but now you're playing too dangerously to the nuclear sandbox. And that's why he went out and made the statement that he made, and seemed like he was, he didn't know where he was. I don't think we're going to see this.
You'd hope not, but I think that it holds true what I said about Soleimani, and that there's a number two and a number three who may be worse waiting in the wings to take his place. In the United States, there are all kinds of hawkish colonels who would love to be a brigadier general, if there's a vacancy at the top because somebody, we had that one incident with the Navy SEAL who was himself a terrible murderer, who Trump pardoned. His entire, this person's entire Navy SEAL team came forward and said, this guy is a crazy, crazed murderer, and we want nothing to do with him. And Trump still pardoned him and then said, you need not just pardon him, you need to reinstate him in the military. And when the chief of the Navy, who was in charge of the Navy SEALs, opposed him, he was fired. And who was he replaced with? Well, I'm sure there was a slightly more compliant rear admiral who was willing to move up, and Trump replaces them. I mean, the rot just goes to the top.
I think the military was willing to let him go so far, but this far, no further.
I haven't seen any evidence that there's a line drawn at any point.
We won't see that evidence. But I think the evidence that we saw was that press conference Trump gave where he seemed to be in dreamland. He was put up to that. He was forced to do that. He did not do that because he wanted to. Trump, he goes out there, wants to rah, 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 rah. He doesn't want to go out there and be sleepy McAdderall. Mm-hmm. And so clearly someone stepped on his testicles and made it clear that this is what you need to do, and you need to wind this down. And I mean, it's scary when you're in a world where the Iranians are more responsible with their military forces than the United States. They made a proportional response with their attack on those air bases, but they gave warnings so there'd be no loss of life in advance, which is typically what Israelis do in the Middle East when they're going to bomb a target.
And what the U.S.
has done in the past.
Yeah, and they admitted that they shot it down. I mean, within 2 days, I mean, sure, they did a lot of posturing at first and all the rest, and I'm sure they knew almost immediately because you go around to your anti-aircraft batteries in the area and go, are you missing a couple of missiles? Pretty soon you find out, we fired a couple of missiles, are bad. So they knew it. It took them 2 days to do it. And, when the United States shot down that Iranian jetliner in 1988, they finally, the International Court of Justice took the Americans to court over it. And it wasn't until 1996 that the United States recognized it as a terrible tragedy and expressed regret over it.
But did not take responsibility.
But did not admit any legal liability.
No, but they did pay out reparations. Yeah, they did,
about $6 million, but they never apologized for it.
Yeah. The thing is, you and I are both upset about one thing that you just identified, which is that Republicans are saying that Democrats, progressives, anybody who is upset about the process or the lack of process
is a terrorist lover.
That Trump, ignored rule of law and simply behaved like a dictator. Anybody who is upset about the breakdown of systems that are put in place to stop this sort of thing, or at least to allow someone to take a breath, like a waiting period for buying a gun, that anybody who says it's not right, we're not talking about Soleimani, whether, his quality as a human being. We're saying our concern is Western democracy and the United States putting itself forward, as it always has, as the bulwark of Western democracy, and them not following their own rules. And the Republicans are saying, in order to discredit anybody who says, hey, this was just done wrong, this was badly timed, it was not strategic, and it didn't follow the rule of law. It's like Carl Sandburg said, you're a lawyer, you'd recognize this. If the facts are against you, argue the law. If the law is against you, argue the facts. If the law and the facts are against you, pound the table and yell like hell. And that's what they're doing. They know that the criticism of how Trump went about this is legitimate and has basis in law. But they can't admit that. So instead, they'd rather call their dogs to attack the people who are concerned about American institutions like the Constitution, and have them paint anybody who's concerned about the constitutional aspects of this as people who are in love with Iranians and on the side of Iran. They prefer to do that to confuse the issue rather than have to admit that, okay, this was a step too far. But speaking of a step too far, we've talked, there's a lot we can talk further about this, and I hope we don't have to talk further about this. I hope that this is, Iran said that they are standing down for the time being. I hope that the U.S. stands down. And I'm terribly sorry for, I mean, at the end of the day, the people on that Ukrainian Airlines flight were men and women, husbands and wives, children, grandparents, business people, just like any of us take airplanes every day. And I can't, listen, when I had my car accident when I was 16, the most terrifying moment for me was the split second when I realized that there was no way I was going to be able to prevent this accident. This was going to happen. And I went face first into my steering wheel. When the brakes and the steering locked on my car on a wet road, I had nightmares for years about that flash moment when I realized something's going to happen here. It could result in my death, and there's not a damn thing I can do. And this is what the people on that airplane experienced when the plane was hit by this missile, and they knew they were going to die. The pilots did the best they could to try to bring the plane down. It was impossible. The horror, the terror of these people, men, women, and children, knowing that they're going to die, that their death is imminent. It is out of the blue and imminent. That horror that they are feeling is the thing that keeps me up at night. It keeps haunting me, is all of those people, Canadians and non-Canadians, who were on that flight, who realized their lives were about to end, that they were watching the last moments of their life, and they were watching it out of the blue in a very violent way. That horror, that lack of control and realizing your life's about to end, that horror is something that haunts me. And I think that on a human level, it should haunt anybody when you realize that that's what they were facing. And the human tragedy here, a lot of people like to talk about the political, geopolitical, domestic political ramifications, because there's very unpopular governments in both the United States and Iran. In Iran, there's a lot of Iranian citizens who do not support the Iranian government, just like there's a lot of Americans who do not support the current American government. People like to talk about the big geopolitical issues, but the thing that really haunts me is the smaller stuff, like Michael McCain pointed out, which is these people who lost their lives, and we can't do anything for them now and for the horror that they went through, but for the horror that is going to go on for their loved ones, the survivors, who know in their head that their loved ones, their last moments, were of sheer terror. Yeah. That for me is the thing that we really, really need to focus a lot more on.
Yeah. And as Trudeau said too, I mean, because of the situation in Iran, a lot of these people had left Iran because of the troubles. I've had the pleasure and privilege of having, like to call themselves Persians, to distinguish themselves from the current regime. I've had a lot of Persian clients, and they are highly educated, proud people.
Classy, dignified.
And you just look at the life stories, I mean, the history of the people who, you know, we're getting the personal stories of these people, and they're doctors, they're scientists, they're graduate students. I mean, these are people who have and could have made tremendous contributions to Canadian society. I mean, they were the kind of people we want to come to this country, and it's a tremendous loss. You know, it's a tragedy for their families, and it's a real loss for Canada as well. because you know, we've lost some incredibly wonderful people to a terrible tragedy that was completely unnecessary. And you know, and that's where a lot of the anger comes. People just want, you know, they don't know who to be angry with. I mean, they're obviously angry at the Iranian government, and like McCain, they're also saying, "I'm angry at Trump as well, because but for you, this would not have happened."
And I think that's a fair criticism. I think that's a fair comment, because but for him trying to change the channel, literally on the cable news networks that were talking about impeachment, he set in motion the sequence of events that led to the loss of innocent life on that airliner. And yeah, you can put that at his feet. He didn't fire the missile that took down that plane, but he fired the drone that led to the firing of that missile. You know, it's like dominoes fallen. And it's, listen, it's a tragedy all around. It's a tragedy. It's a human tragedy. It's a tragedy for the victims. It's a tragedy for the survivors. It's a tragedy for the U.S. rule of law and their further descent into abandoning the Constitution as their ruling document and descending into mob rule and a cult of personality. There's nothing there. You know, you hope sometimes some tragedies you can pull some learning from this that will make the world a better place. No, there's nothing, unfortunately. That we can pull from this.
We won't be enlightened either. And, you know, in the weeks and years to come, I say, you know, Iran will no doubt offer up a couple of military types, the people who actually pulled the trigger on the missiles, and they'll execute them just to show the world they're serious about that. And we'll never hear anything more. The black box won't tell us anything. We've got Canadians going over there, but they've already bulldozed the site. We won't learn anything more. I mean, it was a missile that shot down an airliner. I don't know what more there is to learn. And on the American side, we'll never learn about Trump's, you know, I'll put it in air quotes, his thinking when he decided to set all these things in motion by ordering the killing of Soleimani. We will never have any clarity on this. And sometimes life doesn't just give you any clarity, and that's a real tragedy too.
Yeah, I agree. And if you are listening and you're interested in further discussion about the human element of this tragedy, please, on FU Politics, there was a show recorded yesterday. I had the privilege of hosting it, a FU Politics report. We took lessons from the Air India tragedy that happened in Canada in 85 and applied what was learned then and how we can apply that learning to dealing with the people, the survivors now. And we had two guests, one of whom was the director of the Secretariat, who was charged with investigating that Air India bombing here in Canada. And a woman who was in first grade, and her good friend and first grade classmate was one of the people who died on that plane. And we look at the human costs and the human reactions to these things, and what can be learned and what was learned from Air India and how it applies today, and what we can take from that and use in the wake of this horrible tragedy. But I just encourage you to check it out. It's just called FU Politics Report, and it was put online on the 12th of January. So take a listen to that. So Stephen, on this, you know, often you and I are fairly jocular, but there are times to laugh and times not to laugh. And this is not a time for callous jokes and humor, and I think I hope people listening had the chance to see the issues in the light of day, to see that there's in fact a number of issues, not one or two issues, and not line up basically whether you're left or right and drink the Kool-Aid and speak the talking points. Recognize that there's a lot to be discussed here on many, many levels, and should be discussed. And is this the time to discuss politics at a time like this, with a tragedy like this? Yes, unfortunately, because otherwise it just gets pushed to the side. It's amazing in the United States how when there's mass shootings, the people who support gun rights say this isn't the time to politicize this. And then after the news moves on, the news cycle moves on, the time to politicize it, which is what they're alluding to, which is then, doesn't happen because the news cycle has moved on. Unfortunately, you have to politicize these things. You have to talk about the politics involved when the wound is raw. You don't score cheap political shots and cheap political points, but there are serious issues that need to be and should be addressed. And that doesn't make you, if you're questioning what Trump did, it doesn't make you a communist. It doesn't make you a lefty. It doesn't make you a libtard. It makes you somebody who's concerned about institutions, democratic institutions, crumbling in the country that for years held itself up as the shining light, the symbol of the rebirth of democracy in the modern world.
And we promise next week we'll be back to being smartasses ourselves.
That's right. I promise an increase to smartassery next week on our program. But Stephen, thank you for your contributions, and thank you for your words and for your historical knowledge and context and knowledge of the law. And thank you to everybody out there who's listening. You're listening to Stephen and Stephen on FU Politics, which is part of Fund the FU Network. If you'd like to keep conversations like this going, then you can be a part of that process by supporting us through either a subscription, which starts at $1 a month and goes upwards to whatever you can afford. That comes through a company called Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/FU Network TV, all one word, FU Network TV. And if you don't want to be committing to once a month to something ongoing, but you'd like to help us out with a donation to help keep the lights on, quite frankly, the laptop that we used to launch this network that recorded all these shows just died a short time ago, and it's not in the budget to replace it. So, if you want to help us replace or repair that laptop, we're working on equipment that needs maintenance. People aren't taking a fee or a salary for this. We're doing it because we believe that the conversations that are happening on FU Politics are the kind of conversations that need to happen and that need to be accessible to people who are really interested in what's going on in the world around them, but find a lot of news coverage in the mainstream media and in cable news has a barrier to understanding. And that barrier is a lot of jargon and a lot of talking points by paid proxies and pundits. So if you want to support what we're doing, please contribute patreon.com/FU Network TV or a donation one time at PayPal. And PayPal, you do that through our email address, which is funetworktv@gmail.com. Stephen, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And thank all of you for listening. This has been Stephen and Stephen on FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network.
I'm Ed Nasok, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com/FU Network TV, and through PayPal at FU Network TV @gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader.